The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. And we'll start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the special section report, Women in Business Awards. Geraldine Dawson of Duke Health wins the Lifetime Achievement Award for her work in the field of psychology and neuroscience and her push to forge corporate partnerships to forward her research. And the article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with another headline, Women in Business Awards Lifetime Achievement, Geraldine Dawson, Duke professor finds her calling in researching autism and serving as an advocate for the people it impacts. This is written by Zach Ezone. From the clinic to Capitol Hill, autism research and advocacy has served as the focus of Geraldine Dawson's career. This work began when Dawson was a graduate student earning a degree in development and child clinical psychology at the University of Washington. Her first case was a young child diagnosed with autism, which was considered a rare condition at that point. It was really clear to me at that time that we had very little to offer the child and the family, Dawson says. I made a commitment at that time that this was going to be what I do with my career. Several decades later, Dawson is now the director of the Duke Center for Autism and Brain Development, one of 9 autism centers of excellence supported by the National Institutes of Health. These are centers focused on interdisciplinary research aimed to improve the lives of those diagnosed with autism through research, education, clinical services, and policy. It's a highly competitive program that Dawson's center joined in 2017 with an initial 5-year award. The NIH last year awarded the center another 5-year term and $12 million to support its research. This includes developing artificial intelligence tools for detecting autism during infancy and identifying brain-based biomarkers of autism. Aside from the research, a key focus of Dawson's work is to advocate for neurodiversity at Duke and elsewhere. We do work to advocate for the hiring and inclusion of neurodivergent people in the workplace and people on the autism spectrum, and to really recognize the unique talents that people who are different than neurotypical person can bring to a business environment, Dawson says. Dawson joined Duke after 5 years of serving as the chief science officer for an advocacy organization called Autism Speaks. Dawson left academia and joined the organization in 2008. And moved to a different side of scientific research, implementation. Science is, of course, essential, Dawson says, but if science only results in an article that's in a journal that's on a shelf in a library and doesn't have any real impact on people's lives, then we haven't really done our job. For instance, while a professor at the University of Washington, Dawson worked with a colleague to develop an evidence-based model for early intervention for young children diagnosed with autism called the Early Start Denver Model. This model is now used worldwide and has been translated into 17 languages. But when Dawson first joined Autism Speaks, these types of interventions were not covered by insurance. Through this advocacy work, Dawson aimed to change that. I was able to testify to the Senate on behalf of legislation to improve insurance funding for early intervention, Dawson says. Now, most states in the U.S. do have legislation that ensures coverage, including North Carolina. While Dawson enjoyed this full-time advocacy work, she missed academia and began looking for opportunities while already living in the Triangle. She commuted from North Carolina to New York during her time at Autism Speaks. And this wasn't her first time in the Triangle. After graduating in 1979, Dawson went through a clinical internship at the University of California, Los Angeles, before landing her first job as a professor at UNC Chapel Hill. Dawson spent 5 years in Chapel Hill before moving and returning to the University of Washington. During her 2 decades at her alma mater, Dawson worked toward developing the Early Start Denver model, which she says is her most important career accomplishment, and her efforts to improve methods for early detection and intervention continue at Duke. These efforts include an approach that uses technology to objectively quantify changes in a child's behavior. Dawson and her colleagues have developed a mobile app for iPhones and iPads that involves showing a baby a set of movies designed to elicit different behavioral responses. The camera in the device records the child's behavior, which is automatically coded and can be used as part of a screening process to reduce disparities in autism diagnosis and early intervention. After validating this work at Duke Primary Care and Clinics, the researchers launched a pivotal trial that could take up to 4 years and lead to the app being used in clinical practices. It's been a very gratifying career where we have made great progress in early detection of autism and early interventions, Dawson says, but we still have a long ways to go. And along with that article, here's a closer look, 6 questions with this year's Lifetime Achievement winner. What accomplishments from the last year made you the most proud? The Duke Center for Autism and Brain Development, for which I am the founding director, was renewed as a National Institutes of Health Autism Center of Excellence with an additional $12 million of research funding to apply cutting-edge artificial intelligence methods to improve autism detection and discover brain-based autism biomarkers. What are your professional goals 5 years from now? Over the next 5 years, the Duke Center for Autism will apply cutting-edge translational digital health and computational methods to develop more effective tools for autism screening and discover novel brain-based biomarkers. Our vision is to transform how clinical care is delivered by providing innovative solutions that address long-standing barriers to access to care and enhance our ability to test interventions that will improve the quality of life of those on the autism spectrum. What is the most difficult obstacle you faced? Despite significant progress in improving access to the support and services that are needed to improve the quality of life for autistic individuals and their families, we face significant ongoing barriers based on the limitations and priorities of our current health systems and discrimination and biases that remain part of our society. To what community cause or charity are you most committed? The Autism Society of North Carolina is one of the most effective and compassionate community organizations supporting autistic people in our state. What female leader do you admire most? The 2020 Nobel Prize in Chemistry was awarded to 2 women, Emmanuelle Charpentier and Jennifer Doudna, who discovered the CRISPR-Cas9 system that allows scientists to make precise modifications to DNA. CRISPR is impacting all fields of science and medicine involving genes, from curing diseases such as sickle cell anemia to allowing us to better understand how the brain functions. What is something you are looking forward to this year? Spending more time with my family and in the garden. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Interest dims in ER doctors. Match day for medical students fell on St. Patrick's Day this year, and medical schools across the country celebrated their new pairings with young doctors. But the day continued an interesting and concerning trend as fewer students selected residencies in emergency medicine. In fact, according to the American Medical Association, emergency medicine offered 3,010 positions, but 554 were unfilled after matches were announced. Last year, that number was 219. Dr. Nikki Benz, the director of UNC Chapel Hill's emergency medicine residency program, says she and her colleagues are worried. Interest in top schools remains intense, with 1,400 applicants for the 13 UNC slots for emergency medicine, but even that is down from the 1,500 applications last year. Ben sees a variety of reasons for the dip, including that students can easily see and sense how difficult the jobs have been recently with the pandemic. Our jobs have gotten harder in emergency medicine. Our patients are sicker. They are more complicated. Our healthcare system has become more complicated, she says. And Benz adds, we are the safety net for our healthcare system, and our safety net has grown bigger and without necessarily any more resources. ECU Health Medical Center's emergency program matched all 12 positions for first-year residents, and 5 students at ECU's Brody School of Medicine matched into emergency medicine. As for filling ER jobs, Ben says there is plenty of interest in major cities, but she worries about rural areas. All educators are concerned, she says. We want to make sure we are training the best and the brightest who will be excellent physicians when they finish. It is not an easy job, but it is also rewarding, and you want to be sure you are finding the right people. If it wasn't your calling and your passion, it's going to be hard to endure. Midwest Coffee Company makes debut here. A major Midwest coffee chain is splashing into the Triangle. Big B Coffee, a favorite in its home state of Michigan, is now open on Six Forks Road in Raleigh. The coffee brand has over 280 stores across 12 states, all of which are franchise locations. 2 Raleigh couples, Lloyd and Caitlin Forns, and Michael and Candace Garland, teamed up to open a location at 5424 Six Forks Road. The team has a second store in the works for 4208 Pleasant Valley Road. Besides Starbucks and Dunkin', the majority of the area's coffee spots are independent local businesses. One of the brand's competitors, Caribou Coffee, has four locations in the Triangle. Satellite Tour finds new home. A longtime golf tournament in Raleigh is on the move this year. The Corn Ferry Tour stop that has been held at the Country Club of Wakefield Plantation will move to Raleigh Country Club June 1st through 4th. The event, officially the UNC Health Championship, includes a heavy dose of talented golfers looking to prime their games for a shot at the PGA Tour. Both Wakefield and Raleigh Country Club are owned by McConnell Golf. Raleigh Country Club, a Donald Ross course that dates to 1948, underwent a major renovation in 2020, overseen by Kyle Franz. Our main reason for moving the tournament is to get closer to downtown and attract new fans, McConnell Golf CEO John McConnell says. We want to return to the place that put Raleigh on the golf map. Engineering firm expands here. A civil engineering firm and environmental consulting firm both expanded to a new, larger location in the Triangle. Morris and Ritchie Associates of North Carolina and GTA Associates Incorporated have been providing services in North Carolina since 2006, with their first Raleigh office opening in 2015 on Chapel Hill Road. The companies have provided services for numerous residential, commercial, utility, and infrastructure projects. The new office is at 530 Hinton Pond Road, Suite 104 in Knightdale, in the Merritt Midway Business Park. Both companies are growing, and this expanded location accommodates that growth. It also includes an expanded soil, concrete, and asphalt testing lab for GTA. Principals Jamie Guerrero and Jeremy Keeney will head up Morris and Ritchie Associates office. GTA Vice President W. Sean Sullivan will head up GTA's office. Both companies are based in Harvard County, Maryland, and have a total staff of more than 700. The firms have 25 offices throughout the Southeast, Mid-Atlantic, and Midwest regions. These counties are no longer rural. As North Carolina continues to attract transplants from other states, some formerly rural counties are losing their remote status. The counties of Johnston and Onslow, home to Jacksonville, are now classified as regional city suburban, says Patrick Woody, president and CEO of the North Carolina Rural Center. Our state population continues to shift, as it has for decades, in the direction of increased urbanization and suburbanization, he says. Johnston County is benefiting from growth spilling out of Wake County and homebuyers seeking cheaper land costs. And Onslow is seeing increased interest as the North Carolina coast continues to attract more permanent residents. And finally, tech troubles having an impact. It seems the troubles of the tech sector are starting to hit home in North Carolina and the Triangle. Amid the constant drumbeat of layoffs across big tech, new data shows the number of tech job postings in the state nosedived in February, falling more than 28% from the prior month. The figure stood at 21,157 last month, down from nearly 30,000 in January and way below the 36,000 postings from February 2022, according to the NC Tech Association's latest report. In Raleigh, the number of postings was 6,144, down 40% year over year. And now we turn to some of the major stories in the Triangle Business Journal. The first one, written by Kaylee Thompson, Hayes-Barton community escalates fight over townhomes. A heated dispute over proposed townhomes in Raleigh's Hayes-Barton neighborhood is heading to court. Three sets of homeowners have filed a lawsuit in an attempt to undo a key change to zoning rules approved by the City Council in 2021 that allows for more housing types and higher density in neighborhoods that traditionally have single-family homes. Known as missing middle zoning, the text change cleared the way for Concept 8 Holdings to propose 17 townhomes at 908 Williamson Drive, which now holds a home from 1925. Attorney Frank Gordon with Milberg Gordon Stewart filed the lawsuit in Wake County Superior Court on behalf of the plaintiffs. It seeks to find that the city's missing middle ordinances are invalid and therefore void. It argues the changes were not simply a text change, but rather zoning map changes and amendments. This is not the way you're supposed to change zoning rules, and it's not fair. It smacks of wrongness, Gordon says. At the end of the day, all we're asking for is the city to start over and do it in an appropriate way. The city's attorney's office did not respond to a request for comment. Michael Birch of Longleaf Law Partners represents the development entities named in the suit, which are linked to developer Johnny Chapel. Missing middle housing is an important part of the city's approach to creating more attainable housing options as compared to perpetuating existing development patterns, Birch says. Unfortunately, these appeals aim to decrease housing options and increase housing costs throughout the city. Chapel says none of this would be happening if they weren't attempting to develop townhomes in the neighborhood. Hayes Barton is one of Raleigh's most desirable neighborhoods. The city has not yet issued any permits for the project. Credit Suisse fall could hit RDP. Swiss Bank has a major presence in the Triangle, but is now owned by UBS. This article is written by Lauren Onasorge. The UBS deal to take over troubled Credit Suisse could have major implications for the Triangle. The Swiss banks announced March 19 they had entered into a merger agreement with UBS to emerge as the surviving entity. Credit Suisse will continue to conduct its business in the ordinary course and implement its restructuring measures in collaboration with UBS, Credit Suisse says. A company spokesperson declines to answer questions about how the deal could impact Research Triangle Park, where Credit Suisse has a large operation. The Credit Suisse campus spreads across 63 acres in RTP. As of last year, the company employed 2,300 in the region, making it one of the area's largest employers. As the two banks offer similar services, redundancies created from the merger could mean major cuts, and layoffs could hit the Triangle, where Credit Suisse has grown its headcount since the local campus opened in 2005. Today, it has positions in business continuity, information technology, and operational support services. The RTP campus started primarily as a tech hub, though over time, other business units would move employees to the Triangle. 6 years ago, Credit Suisse announced an expansion to create 1,200 jobs. By 2018, Credit Suisse had a team of about 2,700 in the Triangle, but rough patches followed, including news last year of a strategic overhaul and radical restructuring action. Records with the North Carolina Department of Commerce show that of the 1,200 jobs the company committed to creating, it had created 883 as of 2021. When announcing the deal with UBS, Axel Lehman, chairman of the board of directors of Credit Suisse, said that given recent extraordinary and unprecedented circumstances, the merger is the best possible option. This has been an extremely challenging time for Credit Suisse, and while the team has worked tirelessly to address many significant legacy issues and execute on its new strategy, we are forced to reach a solution today that provides a durable outcome, Lehman said. The Swiss Federal Department of Finance, the Swiss National Bank, and FINMA, a Swiss financial supervisor, asked the companies to enter into the deal in order to restore necessary confidence in the stability of the Swiss economy and banking system. The deal came a week after the regulatory takeovers of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank of New York in the U.S., the second and third largest bank failures in the country. Chatham land hits market for $51 million. This is written by Evan Hooper. A piece of land in Chatham County could fetch a huge price tag. In the Moncure area of Chatham County, 339.36 acres is for sale. The advertised price is $50.9 million, or $150,000 an acre. Lee & Associates is marketing the property. The land is adjacent to the planned VinFast factory that the Vietnamese company has said will employ 7,500 workers at full build-out, which makes it ideal for automotive suppliers, says Moss Withers, principal and CEO of Lee & Associates, Raleigh-Durham. VinFast is delaying the start of production at its factory until at least 2025, but Withers doesn't think the delay will deter interest in the land. The demand for this site will be specific to VinFast, but ultimately, no one could deliver on this site faster than VinFast, so no concerns connected with their delay, he says. The land would need to be rezoned to allow for industrial development. Withers says this kind of land is hard to find in the Triangle. Larger industrial sites are impossible to come by, Withers says. I can share that there is probably not one 100-acre contiguous site within Wake County that can be slated for industrial. The larger users are needed to look outside a bit at areas like Sanford, Moncure, Smithfield, Selma, and Zebulon. Citrix subleasing downtown Raleigh building. This is written by Lauren Onasorge. A decade ago, Citrix Systems appeared to be taking over Raleigh. Today, It's planning to sublease much of its downtown building, marking the end of an era in the warehouse district. Citrix, which entered the region with its buyout of Raleigh-based ShareFile, was taken private last year and a new entity was created, Cloud Software Group. ShareFile is now a standalone business unit within that company, and a spokesman says it will continue to use the space, but not all of it, so the remainder is available for lease. The company is subleasing 153,000 square feet at 120 Southwest Street. The entire building is just over 171,000 square feet. The company had already vacated and let the lease expire on another 19,000 square foot annex building at nearby 100 Southwest Street. Citrix is also a business unit of Cloud Software Group, spokesman Eric Armstrong says. Employees of that business unit and the corporate employees of Cloud Software Group who previously maintained offices in the Southwest Street location now work remote. Economic developers are pitching the site. Kyle Touchstone, director of Raleigh Economic Development, says the space creates a great opportunity for new jobs and investment in the heart of the warehouse district. The included parking is a major plus for the property, he says. We're actively working with the brokers to market the property to new and or expanding companies who want access to Raleigh's talent pipeline and quality of life. RDU Airport approves $326 million budget. Raleigh-Durham International Airport has approved a $326 million budget for its new fiscal year, a plan that includes earmarks for major projects such as the new international runway and terminal improvements. The Raleigh-Durham Airport Authority Board approved the budget during its regular March meeting. Board member David Kushner said the airport doesn't have a choice but to fund additional gates at Terminal 1, as expansion is limited at Terminal 2 until the completion of the new runway. The airport is forecasting nearly 14.7 million passengers for its fiscal 2023-24 year. By fiscal 2026-27, that number is projected to eclipse 16 million. We would be totally hamstrung if we did not move forward with the Terminal 1 gate expansion program, Kushner said. RDU reported more than 888,000 passengers for February, a 26.7% increase from 2022. Last month's total was down about 7.8% compared to February 2020, just before the pandemic hit. Staffing and benefits represent about half of the airport's operational budget. RDU wants to increase its current headcount of 391 to 423 in the next fiscal year. The airport expects personnel costs to rise by $10.5 million as a result of staff additions and other factors such as rising pension costs. In the 2023-24 fiscal year, the airport hopes to start $16.5 million worth of new projects. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Retail and Restaurants page written by Laura Bromette. Doggy Ice Cream coming to Raleigh. Salty Paws, based out of Delaware, offers treats fit for dogs. Raleigh already boasts large dog parks, dog-friendly breweries, and a dog bar. Now the city will have an ice cream shop for canines. Salty Paws, a chain selling ice cream and retail goodies for dogs, is opening in Kane Realty's Smoky Hollow development on the edge of Glenwood South. Salty Paws will be located directly next to the former J Lights Cafe space, according to a coming soon sign. J Lights recently announced it had closed after a brief run in Smoky Hollow, is one of the few tenants already open in the mixed use development's courtyard area. Near Smoky Hollow is West Street Dog, a bar that caters to pet owners. It opened in 2021 at 400 Northwest Street. Salty Paws is slated to open this summer and says it will be the first of its kind in North Carolina. The brand sells ice cream in scoops like a typical ice cream parlor, but without lactose and white processed sugar, making the treat safe for dogs. The company lists 12 different flavors with options for adding toppings. The Raleigh location's franchisee is already planning a second location in North Hills. Menu images show a single scoop costing $4.99, two scoops at $5.99, and waffle bowls at $6.99. Toppings including chicken, rabbit, turkey, and peanut butter are an additional dollar. Salty Paws will have other varieties of ice cream along with frozen treats available for human consumption. Salty Paws will also have a retail selection featuring natural dog treats, toys, dehydrated foods, and bakery items. The brand also offers events including birthday parties, corporate socials, and fundraising. The company was founded in 2018 as the first dog ice cream shop in the country, its website says. It is based in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, and has more than 20 locations. Salty Paws began franchising in 2019. Online listings show the total franchise investment between $50,000 to $100,000. The new store is opening at a time when inflation and other headwinds have economists expecting consumer spending to cool in 2023. New Carrie Bar offers cocktails, art, and axe throwing. Carrie's list of nightlife offerings continues to grow, but the newest bar in town comes with a sharp twist. Graffiti, a bar offering cocktails, art, and axe throwing, is now open. Located at 158 East Cedar Street, Graffiti features a high-end cocktail menu, six axe throwing lanes, and a street art theme. Graffiti is owned by a local team operating as Reward Hospitality Group. The bar also offers a variety of spirits, wine, domestic cans and bottles, and a rotating list of craft beers on draft. In an ode to the bar's name, Graffiti features colorful street art by local artists across its walls. And finally, Raleigh's first Westin Hotel opening. The Westin Raleigh-Durham Airport is scheduled to open in April in Briar Creek. The new hotel features 236 rooms and suites, a rooftop pool, and a full-service restaurant. CMC Hotels, a local hotel developer and operator, is behind the new property. The Westin location was first announced in 2019 with plans to open in mid-2021. The Westin brand is an upscale chain owned by Marriott International. The location is the first Westin in the Triangle and second in the state. The new Raleigh Hotel will feature a lounge with a full bar, an Italian restaurant, 24-hour room service, and a Starbucks, and rain-style showers in guest rooms. And now we turn to the On Greater Triangle Growth page, written by Evan Hoopfer. First Health to open $68 million cancer center. New cancer center in Pinehurst serves growing need. Leadership from First Health of the Carolinas has seen the rate of cancer patients rise, so the health system decided a dedicated cancer facility is necessary. That's the origin behind the new $68 million, 120,000-square-foot First Health Cancer Center slated to open on the campus of Moore Regional Hospital in Pinehurst this month. Our cancer program, while growing, has been disjointed, says Mickey Foster, the CEO of First Health. He says many different facets of care are located across the campus in separate buildings. The vision was to bring a one-stop-shop outpatient cancer center where a patient can only go one place to receive all of the care that they need, Foster says. He says this expansion will add staff in the several dozen range to fill out operations. Today, First Health has about 5,600 employees. The cancer center is four stories. The first three floors are dedicated to treatment, while the fourth floor features a fitness center, massage therapy, yoga classes, and classrooms for support groups. The fourth floor will be used entirely as a space where people can have a different experience, Foster says. We wanted a floor where patients can get away from their daily treatment and family members of those patients can get away, Foster says. First Health, based in the Moore County village of Pinehurst, serves a mostly rural population. Its 15-county coverage region stretches north to Chatham and Lee counties, and the hospital even sees patients from northern South Carolina. First Health Moore Regional Hospital is the 13th largest hospital in the Greater Triangle, according to Triangle Business Journal research, based on its number of licensed beds. VinFast execs leave as NC plant delayed. Three high-level executives have left VinFast, the company confirms. The three executives' departures are Gareth Dunsmore, Deputy Chief Executive for Global Sales and Marketing, Greg Tebbett, Chief Marketing Officer, and Craig Westbrook, Chief Service Officer. A VinFast spokesperson says Dunsmore's departure was for personal reasons and did not elaborate. The spokesperson added that the departures of Tebbett and Westbrook were due to changes in management model and specific requirements of the business. And finally, a developer awarded $5 million in legal dispute with NCDOT. A jury has awarded a Harnett County developer more than $5 million after the North Carolina Department of Transportation took a key piece of property needed to develop a hotel in Dunn. The award represents a 20-fold increase over what the department initially offered Amar Patel, who purchased the hotel at 510 Spring Branch Road in Dunn with the intention of redeveloping the property, says Jeremy Hopkins, an attorney with Cranfield Sumner, who represented Patel. An agreement was eventually reached to turn the property property into a Holiday Inn Express and Suites. But in 2020, the NCDOT exercised its right of eminent domain as it sought to expand Interstate 95 and put a permanent utility easement that went up to the building. And now we turn to the On Healthcare page written by Zach Ezone. Novon needs capital to manage FDA review. Company is months away from potentially obtaining approval. After years of development, a medical dermatology company in Durham may be months away from obtaining regulatory approval for its lead project, but it will need more cash to see the process through. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration earlier this month accepted Novon's new drug application and is set to make a decision in January. Short on cash, Novon will need to raise additional capital amid a challenging environment to reach that date. Novon ended last year with an estimated $12.3 million in cash based on unaudited results. The company has not yet released its 2022 full-year results. Novon added another $6 million with a stock offering earlier this month. Novon CEO Paula Brown Stafford says the company is of about 90 employees, is optimizing its cash usage to further extend its runway while evaluating its options. We need cash to get to January, Stafford says. It's always a multi-pronged approach as an emerging company. Novon has a few options to raise the capital it needs, says Kemp Dolliver, director of research at Brookline Capital Markets. The question is how and when the company raises capital. A non-dilutive option could see Novon pursue licensing deals with companies in other countries. For instance, Novon in December granted the Japanese company Sato Pharmaceutical the right to develop and market a commercial product Novon acquired last year called Rofade. Through this deal, Novon landed an upfront payment of $5 million with the potential for future payments. Novon could also pursue additional equity offerings like its recent $6 million raise and accept whatever terms are available. If this were 2020 or 2021, they could probably raise money much more easily, Dolliver says, but it's more difficult in the current environment. This cash position is fairly unusual for a company with a new drug application accepted by the FDA, says Jeff Jones, a senior analyst covering biotech for Oppenheimer & Company. Novon is developing a topical gel for the viral skin infection Molluscum contagiosum, which doesn't attract the same attention as other dermatology indications. Pharma raises $5 million as Phase 3 study begins. A Raleigh pharmaceutical company is raising money as it moves its lead drug into a late-stage study. 9 Meters Biopharma closed a stock offering in March that landed the company $5 million in gross proceeds. During a virtual presentation this month at the Oppenheimer 33rd Annual Healthcare Conference, CEO John Temperato said funds will help provide a runway as 9 Meters makes progress on its clinical and preclinical program and looks to secure partnerships to advance its lead asset. Prior to this offering, 9 Meters last reported cash and cash equivalents of about $15.9 million as of September 30. The company is developing vorolanidide, a treatment for short bowel syndrome, a rare disease with limited treatment options that affects about 20,000 patients in the U.S. After disclosing positive results from a Phase 2 study last year, 9 Meters is moving into a Phase 3 study involving 120 patients. And finally, Bryn Pharma names Leroux its new CEO. A pharmaceutical company in Raleigh is making a leadership change as it moves toward filing for regulatory approval for its lead drug candidate. Sandy Leroux will lead Bryn Pharma through its next phase, which includes submitting a new drug application to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration for Utili, an epinephrine nasal spray the company is developing as an alternative to existing treatments for anaphylaxis, such as EpiPen and other generic epinephrine auto-injectors. Bryn's former CEO, David Dworjak, will remain with the company as a senior advisor and head of its regulatory, production, and research and development efforts. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Kaylee Thompson. Developer plans hundreds of homes. Eastern Wake County continues to be a prime area for homes. Hundreds of new homes plus commercial space are being proposed by a Maryland home builder for Eastern Wake County as the Knightdale area continues to boom. DRB Homes, formerly Dan Ryan Builders, is awaiting a final decision from the town of Knightdale on its planned unit development at the corner of Lucas and Horton Roads near Interstate 540. The project, named Weldon, would have 146 homes and 15,000 square feet of commercial space. The homes will be a mix of single-family detached homes and townhomes. The single-family homes will feature three different lot sizes. 41 will be 32 feet wide, 63 will be 60 feet wide, and 5 will be 80 feet wide. There will be 37 townhomes. All homes will be limited to two stories and must have a front porch. The project will be on 41 acres at an unaddressed parcel on Lucas Road. The site is currently vacant and mostly forested. It has an assessed value of $1.2 million and is owned by an LLC addressed to an individual. Site plans show there will be 5.5 acres of active space, including a 2,000-foot linear public greenway, a private greenway, multi-use field, dog park, playground, and fountain. The rest of the open space, 5.91 acres, will be passive. The commercial portion will be one building on a 1.4-acre outparcel. Cost, timeline, and listing price of the homes is unknown, as DRB Homes did not respond to inquiries. The company's homes in nearby Zebulon start in the high 200,000s. D.R. Horton has a community in the same area of Knightdale, and those start in the mid-300,000s. DRB Homes has been active in the Halo counties surrounding the Triangle, with plans for communities in Johnston, Harnett, and Franklin counties. Buffalo Road, to the north of the Weldon project, has been boasting big residential plans lately. On the other side of Buffalo Road from Weldon, properties along Buffalo and Robertson Grove roads were approved in a rezoning to allow for up to 1,000 homes. Pushing west, closer to Interstate 540, are a handful of townhome and apartment plans that have been proposed by development companies. Goodwill buys School of Theology campus. Goodwill Industries of Eastern North Carolina has purchased the campus of a shuttered college in Durham that closed in the wake of a scandal. Goodwill Industries acquired the property of Apex School of Theology for $4.27 million on March 15, according to Durham County records. The school closed in 2020 after former employees were charged with fraud linked to $12 million in federal student aid. Any new plans for the 6.18-acre property at 1701 T.W. Alexander Drive are unclear, as Goodwill did not respond to inquiries. But the commercial broker for the purchase, Vernon Averett with Pickett Sprouse Commercial, says Goodwill purchased the building for its new headquarters. Goodwill will prep it for move-in until its current sublease at Imperial Center is up in 2025. The newly acquired property has a total assessed value of $3.4 million with a building square footage of 16,630. And finally, townhomes planned for downtown Morrisville. A luxury home builder has snagged land in Morrisville to build a new townhome development as the town near the future Apple campus continues to see intense interest. Baker Residential of Cary is ready to start site construction on the Park at Town Center on Church Street near the Morrisville Town Center development. The Park at Town Center will have 41 townhomes ranging from 2,200 to 3,200 square feet. Each townhome will have three bedrooms and a two-car garage. All of the townhomes will have laundry rooms, center island kitchens, and an optional third-floor rec room space. And now we'll read part of a special report in the Triangle Business Journal on the future of cities. This is a Q&A with Richard Florida. Cities will recover, buildings will come down. Richard Florida is ever the optimist when it comes to the resilience of American cities, but even he concedes we're in for a rough ride. A pandemic-driven shift in how and where people work has reinforced what Florida, through his best-selling books and advisory work as an urbanist and historian, has been preaching for years, that the office properties defining our city skylines are relics of a bygone era. Florida recently spoke with Atlanta Business Chronicle broadcast editor Crystal Edmondson about what's needed to get America's cities back on track and the painful challenges that path will entail. What follows is an edited transcript of their conversation. I read recently a quote where someone was talking about the layoffs in the technology sector and a possible slowdown in the overall economy really was a sign that we were entering into a post-pandemic era. Is this accurate? Here's what I think. Our downtowns are uniquely troubled. People aren't going back to the office. Offices have high vacancy. What I want to say is kind of a preface. The old way wasn't great. My mentor, a lady named Jane Jacobs, wrote in about 1958 an essay called Downtown is for People. It's what made her famous before I was born. She basically said monocultural downtowns filled with these giant office towers were not what they should be. They should be better neighborhoods. Now, it took us a long way to get here, but it's finally dawning on people, city leaders, chambers of commerce, advocacy groups, landlords, real estate owners, banks, that we're going to have to change the way we create our downtowns. The good news is we've done that a lot over the past century, and I think we can do it again. Does this post-pandemic economic environment slow or even end the work-from-anywhere movement that we saw during the pandemic? No, I don't think so. This has been building up since before the pandemic. Historically, only about 1% of people work from home. Before the pandemic, it was about 6%. That's up to about 18%. We're tripling. It's not everybody. It's not a majority of the workforce. It's not even a fifth of the workforce. I think what happened is that we became untethered. That's the word. I don't work at a desk anymore. I think that's happened to many people. As we become untethered and desks no longer became the main workspace, people could spread out. I think that was happening before the pandemic. I think the pandemic supercharged that. The office that we have is really a 150-year-old artifact. In many cases, it's not a great place to work. There are fluorescent lights, there are cubicle farms, there isn't a lot of privacy. I think the trend now is to make the office look more like your living room or your den, to look more like a really nice hotel lobby. I think that people are going to have to up their game in terms of what they provide to bring workers back to the office and realize they're not going to come in every day. How can cities prepare for what the future holds in this work-from-anywhere environment? Here's what I think. Even though work may shrink at the margin in the central business district, it will expand in areas outside the central business district. You're also going to have tremendous opportunities for workspaces in suburban areas, in outlying areas. People don't just want to work from home. They want to go somewhere to work, and they want to meet with people. It's also finally dawning on people that we're going to have to change the way our downtowns operate. We're going to have to make them better neighborhoods, better communities, not just office tower districts. Let's look at commercial real estate and real estate in general. What advice do you have for landlords? A crisis is a terrible thing to waste. We can't waste this crisis. The greatest challenge that ever hit our cities in our time was industrialization. That was an existential crisis. Our cities, which were once filled with factories, all of those factories boarded up within a very short period of time, they moved out, leaving massive holes, massive unemployment, massive fiscal shortfalls. Cities went bankrupt. No one thought cities could bounce back, but they did. This is a challenge, which is not that great, but somewhat analogous. Here's what will happen. Some buildings, which are not great, will have to come down. That's the reality. Some of these older buildings built a half a century ago with the wrong kind of floor plates and windows, they were good for their day. Already commercial real estate firms, large ones, are giving those buildings back to the bank. The people who own those buildings will get hurt. New actors will come in who want to buy up some of those buildings, only highly discounted. Cities will take a revenue shortfall. It's going to be hard to make up the revenue. There's going to be struggles. The people who will be hardest hit are going to be the people who work in those service businesses and the retail shops and the coffee shops and the lunch places and the restaurants who have to go out and find another job in hard times. Ultimately, this will happen. We've seen it happen before. And this was edited by Craig M. Douglas. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor-in-chief of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, CRE Loans May Determine Economy's Future. Again, we turn to real estate, but unlike 2008 to 2009, when residential real estate loan portfolios started the Great Recession, this time all eyes will likely be on commercial real estate. So what does that mean? To make sense, we looked at the overall commercial real estate data tracked by TREP, a data analyzer in the field of structured finance and commercial real estate. TREP estimates that about $2.3 trillion in commercial real estate debt is held by smaller banks, more than 70% of total CRE debt. The company's guidance, released earlier in the month, shows that more than $270 billion of commercial mortgages held by financial institutions will expire by the end of the year, meaning borrowers either need to pay off the loans or refinance the package. And servicing these mortgages are real estate developers, corporations, funds, trusts, and limited partnerships. With a few segments of commercial real estate trying to get their groove back in light of companies laying off workers and corporations agreeing to a remote workforce, the office market has particularly struggled. With interest rates as high as they are, refinancing a loan is going to cost far more than it would just a couple of years ago. But this is the bigger concern. Most of this $270 billion debt is held in banks that are smaller than $250 billion in assets, according to TREP. So if borrowers find themselves struggling to service the debt, banks are left with two choices: work with the borrower to ease the terms, or call on the loan entirely. Of course, if borrowers are able to stay up to date with their debt payments, that would be one of the biggest boons to the U.S. economy in 14 years. But if borrowers start fading away because their revenue intake is smaller due to layoffs, lease givebacks, anemic renewals, and other factors, we may be facing a difficult economic period ahead. The woes at Silicon Valley Bank, tied to its long-term bond investments with short-term borrowings, and Signature Bank and some of the other regionals are primarily tied to investment decisions made by bank leaders. The CRE debt portfolio has not been in the news. The $270 billion commercial mortgages expiration deadline is the largest figure on record, TREP estimates. In February, the commercial mortgage-backed securities, or CMBS, delinquency rate hit 3.2% after falling below 3% in January. We don't want to see that delinquency number gallop to new highs, because if it does, it will hit banks first, and then the rest of the economy. And also on the Viewpoint page, we have a guest column written by Mehmet Demirci, who is a contract photographer with Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Turkey Earthquake, Helpless and Hurting in North Carolina. On the evening of February 6, I completed my photography assignments for the day, and as a daily habit, I took to the internet to check up on world news, especially my motherland, Turkey. Almost every immigrant in this country has a similar routine: check on the news from the country you currently call your home, but also check on developments, incidents, and events unfolding in the country where you were born. February 6 was not a good day for me. A massive earthquake registering some 7.8 on the Richter scale rocked the nation of 85 million people. What was worse is that I first found out that the epicenter was a little more than 100 miles from my hometown in Alexandretta. And here I am trying to process the information by reading Twitter. My next act, completely shaken and fearful of the worst, I pick up the phone to call my family. First call, no answer. Second call, no answer. Third call, no answer. I kept on trying, not completely convinced the phone calls were even going through just moments after a catastrophic earthquake. After more than 10 minutes, there was an answer on the other line. It was my father, who spoke in a cracked voice. We are alive. Almost every regular international traveler, especially to the Middle East, knows that Turkey is known for its earthquakes, but not of this magnitude. So if a natural calamity happens on a regular basis without inflicting much damage, human psychology is to be perhaps annoyed but not worry about it too much. Before the big one, that's how Turkish people treated earthquakes. After getting the assurance that my family was alive, I felt sick. Here I am, thousands of miles away, completely helpless, trying to understand what exactly is going on with my family, friends, teachers, construction workers, and neighbors. That feeling of helplessness worsened with every passing day when rescuers found more and more bodies, and I had trouble reaching most people beyond my family members. My family and I resorted to daily prayers and solitude over the past month, but having a busy life with assignments and kid duties, my wife and I would sometimes erupt with uncontrollable emotions resulting from the helplessness. My American friends called on a regular basis, which was therapeutic. As days passed beyond the physical damage, my dad told me the family house was gone. I just made my last mortgage payment on the house, he had told me months ago, proud of the fact that he no longer had debt on the house. Now my family was left with nothing. They slept in their car for days. Turkish residential and commercial insurance is nothing close to how the sector works in the U.S. The government was busy with cleanup and rescue efforts, and for my parents, asking the federal agency for help was futile. It is unlikely they will even get a portion of the money in the end. As I write this column, my parents are living inside a university dormitory, desperately trying to chart their next move. They have the resolve to start their lives from scratch, and like me, they are thankful that they are still alive. For me, an expatriate, perhaps the most difficult element is the distance. An immigrant's worst nightmare is when you find out about a natural calamity or a man-made event that unleashes this negative energy, destroying lives within minutes, and you can't do anything about it. Any amount of money I send to my family in Turkey is not going to change their somber, pensive reflection on their lives and test their will to move on. And yet, they are the reason I live in America today. And my wife and my kids are enjoying a full life. How do I show them appropriate gratitude over a FaceTime call? At last count, more than 50,000 people died from that earthquake on February 6th. The earthquake also triggered a tsunami, leading to more death and destruction. They say time heals everything, and that's been part of our daily prayer for my family in Turkey, with the hope that someday they will be at peace. But my guilt of not being there in their time of need will live on. And now we'll read the sections called Big Number that are spread throughout the Triangle Business Journal. The first big number, $13.6 million. That's the total economic impact the National Hockey League game played February 18 in Carter-Finley Stadium had last month. More than 57,000 fans watched the Carolina Hurricanes beat the Washington Capitals. The weekend's event saw $20.1 million in economic impact, according to Visit Raleigh. The next number is $9.5 million. The amount a group of New York investors paid for the old Irwin Cotton Mills in the town of Irwin. The group plans on redeveloping the property into the Central Carolina Industrial Park, which will have 1 million square feet of industrial space. $65 million is another big number. That's the funding for Congruence Therapeutics, a startup founded in 2021. It has added $15 million to a $50 million Series A round disclosed about a year ago. The biotech operates offices in Canada and Chapel Hill. $74.1 million. That's how much Stream Realty Partners of Dallas paid to acquire 488,000 square feet of industrial space at Garner Business Park 70 in two separate transactions, according to Wake County records. Stream bought the buildings from AI Nair Executive Managing Director Daniel Farrar, says Stream Realty has no plan on ending current leases. And there's also sections called He Said It or Sometimes She Said It spread throughout the Triangle Business Journal. We'll read some of those now. The first one's from Michael, Mike D. De Los Santos, owner on the expansion of Mike D's Barbecue, a barbecue supply store that is adding a smokehouse. I believe that barbecue is a great way to also build community, and this new smokehouse and retail store will allow for more community building in East Durham. Robbie Davis, chair of the Nash County Commissioners, after he said Nash County has $19 billion worth of projects in its economic development pipeline. It shows Nash County is getting looked at quite a bit. The next quote is from Jim Dayton, the former CEO of Durham-based BioAgilytics, on the opportunity to invest in local companies through his new position as operating partner of London private equity firm Global Healthcare Opportunities. North Carolina is one of the leaders in the world of healthcare, and if we can find the right partners, it's going to be a very exciting time. Next is a quote from Jeff Glenn, Northmark Managing Director, Investment Sales. We have seen a slight uptick in vacancy in apartments, not due to excessive oversupply, rather a return of normal winter seasonality that has been absent during the peak of COVID. And with our remaining time, we'll return to the Women in Business Awards to read some of the different categories and some of the winners. The next one is Entrepreneur, Gabby Angelini, co-founder Gabby's, powered by special abilities. What accomplishments from the last year made you the most proud? Receiving the Employer of the Year Award from the Mayor's Committee for Persons with Disabilities. What are your professional goals 5 years from now? Would like to see Gabby's locations across the world. What is the most difficult obstacle you faced? People not wanting to hire me because I have Down syndrome. To what community cause or charity are you most committed? Committed to my nonprofit, Gabby's, so we can employ a lot of people with special abilities. What female leader do you admire most? Kirsten Williams of Genesis Strategies and NCPRSA. What is something you're looking forward to this year? The Night to Shine prom. And dinner for four, who are you inviting? My boyfriend, Zach Goodrich, Michael Jordan, Ed Sheeran, and Selena Gomez. And in the closer look section, birthplace Carrie, family, mother Mary, father Dan, five brothers, education Millbrook High School, ongoing classes at Wake Tech. And in the nonprofit leadership category, we have Stephanie Hawkins, Vice President, Transformative Unity for Equity, RTI International. What accomplishments from the last year made you the most proud? For 2 years, I worked to build a research organization that uses science in service of equity and social justice because I know both are attainable. In January 2022, with support from leadership team at RTI International, I launched the Transformative Research Unit for Equity and became its founding director. What are your professional goals 5 years from now? I have three areas of focus. One, expand the portfolio and size of my research organization in order to affect greater change in minoritized communities. Two, increase the number of women of color in senior leadership roles within my organization. And three, seek new intellectual challenges through a corporate board of directors experience. What is the most difficult obstacle you faced? Having limited access to mentors and sponsors. To what community cause or charity are you most committed? I am most committed to social justice movements. What female leader do you admire the most? I admire Anita Brown Graham's leadership. I met Anita over 20 years ago and have found her passion for civic involvement and economic mobility inspiring. I've watched her transition from the director role at the Institute for Emerging Issues to becoming the founder and director of the NC Impact Initiative at the UNC School of Government. What is something you're looking forward to this year? Expanding my professional network and my team. And dinner for four, who are you inviting? Michelle Obama to laugh with while also talking about changing the world. Kimberly Williams Crenshaw to learn how her scholarship has turned into a political debate. Ava DuVernay, because of her ability to tell the stories upon which social justice movements have been built, is inspiring. And my daughter. And the closer look information, birthplace New York, family husband Sherman Anderson, sons Gabriel Anderson and Miles Anderson, daughter Maya Anderson, education BA, psychology, Spelman College, MS and PhD, Howard University. And we'll leave you with the Business Pulse survey. The question, should the FDIC remove the $250,000 cap for insured bank deposits? There were 222 responses. 60% say the cap needs to be increased. 25% say yes, and 15% say no. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. And if you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.